Welcome to AMA Edgewise. I'm Dave Summers. AMA Edgewise is brought to you by the American Management Association. Sanjay Khosla and Mohan Sahni are authors of a phenomenal new book entitled Fewer, Bigger, Bolder, From Mindless Expansion to Focused Growth. It was published by Portfolio Penguin. A little bit about the authors. Sanjay Khosla was president of Kraft Foods Developing Markets, where he oversaw revenue growth from $5 billion to $16 billion in 6 years over 60 countries. And since 2013, he's been serving as a management consultant, a senior fellow at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management, and a senior advisor at BCG. Professor Mohan Sahni is a globally recognized scholar, teacher, speaker, and consultant in business innovation, technology marketing, and digital marketing. He directs the Center for Research in Technology and Innovation at the Kellogg School of Management. Gentlemen, welcome to Edgewise.
Great to be here.
I'm just going to jump in here. Your book is really interesting to me because within the space of the title, and we don't even have to get to the subtitle, but within the space of the title, you use three adjectives in a row. It's fewer, bigger, and bolder. Your very first chapter is very interestingly entitled The Seduction of More. Can either one of you or maybe both of you jump in and sort of describe to me what it is that you mean when you say the seduction of more?
In our work that we did, we found that many companies that we studied stretched themselves really, really thin by going for more categories, more products, more markets. And we call this the seduction of more. Fewer, bigger, bolder is really about focusing on fewer things and making them bigger and bolder. And we call this the wisdom of less.
Yeah, now let me amplify the word seduction. The idea there is that companies, they don't make any illogical moves, seemingly, when you look at it one step at a time. You know, one product at a time, one market at a time, one customer segment at a time, one client account at a time. So each incremental move of expansion seems logical. But when you add it all up and when you look at the big picture, the complexity that results from this expansion suddenly creeps up on you.
Mm-hmm.
So these expansion opportunities that always arise for a business in lots of directions, like rabbits popping up all over the woodwork, they all seem seductive. As one of the CEOs we interviewed commented, I never met a revenue dollar I didn't like.
That's right.
But what we argue is that not all revenue dollars are equally green and not all growth is good. And growth can become toxic if it's pursued without discipline. So that's the siren call of growth, if you will.
And do you find that in today's business marketplace that, you know, people are taking the time to pause and do that self-examination that you make a case for in the book? Or do you find that many of them still continue to throw a whole bunch of stuff against the wall and see what sticks?
No, it's the latter, and that's really what came up in our work, whether you're a large multinational company, whether you're a small startup, and independent of industries, we actually found that people were just chasing too many rabbits. And really what we did in Fewer, Bigger, Bolder is develop a seven-step framework called Focus 7, which is a practical, comprehensive framework, which actually goes through then how do you focus where you can win. How do you actually distort resources behind priorities? And how do you make bets on people? So it's a fairly comprehensive, practical seven-step model on how to focus, not just the what.
And if I might add that companies do pause to self-examine, but only after the horse has left the barn, so to speak. When companies hit crisis mode, then they are forced to cut back, they are forced to restructure and to slim down. What we have seen is that in the cases where this sort of slimming down is going on, more often than not, it is past the point at which the crisis has been created. And what we are trying to do here is to argue that you should, as a leadership team, be proactive. And if you follow a disciplined approach, you may not get to that crisis point.
Now, at various points in the book, you gentlemen make a case for and your advocates for this idea of a blank check. I can think of more than one CEO or senior executive team that might get a little bit nervous about the concept of a blank check. What's your justification for that type of thinking?
So this is an idea that I've been experimenting with for over a decade, actually. I'll really give an example of this. When I was in Fonterra, which is one of the largest dairy companies in the world, we give a blank check to the head of the global food service business. And the first reaction when you say, you know what, you've got to really think big and accelerate profitable growth, the first reaction is skepticism. You know, are you nuts? What's this all about? It then goes into the phase of panic and fear because you suddenly realize you've got to do something. And it only then leads to the third phase, which is act. And during the act phase, it becomes very clear very quickly that just doing more of the same will not work. You've got to do something differently. Well, what happened in the Fonterra Global Food Service case is you had accelerated profitable growth and a sustainable business model. Because essentially what the leader of that business did was act like an owner. He realized very quickly that he needed team and skills, some from inside and outside, to make this whole thing work. And since the time frame is short, you have to do something, focus on a bias for action as opposed to a lot of analysis, and get it 80% right rather than precisely wrong. Now, this concept of blank checks has had many failures. It has had many successes. And so long as you learn from your failures, it's actually proved very, very successful. By the way, the other thing that happens is you make people act as an owner, as an entrepreneur, and working in teams. It also develops talent tremendously. So I've been hugely excited by the idea of betting on people and trusting them and then getting out of the way as they, you know, sometimes fail, sometimes succeed. But overall, it's been a great experience.
David, you mentioned the concept of, you know, how do you justify the idea of giving people unlimited resources, which might, actually you mentioned leadership, but the CFOs might get a heart attack. The concept really is to unconstrain resources to liberate the imagination and creativity of people. However, this is what we call freedom within a framework. There is a sandbox. It's not a license to spend like a drunken sailor. So there are a couple of checkpoints here, checks and balances here. One is that a blank check initiative is always needs to fit within the strategic framework. It needs to be on strategy. It needs to be within the priorities that have been defined previously so that you don't go off on a tangent. Secondly, while there is an unconstrained resource pool allocated to the initiative, hence the name blank check, there is a very stringent set of deliverables. You know, it's a, the time frame is short and the numbers, and you're monitored by outputs. You don't monitor the process. But there's a very clear set of agreed-upon deliverables and metrics by which progress and success would be defined and measured. So you let people free. The means are theirs, but the ends are clearly defined and set within the strategy. So the idea here is to give people complete freedom, but to stay within a framework so that it's not just about go spend whatever you want and do whatever you want. So there is accountability and a very, very rigid time frame. So it's kind of like giving people unconstrained resources to achieve unimaginable results within an impossibly short time frame.
If things are not going too well, you course correct. You learn while doing. Now, if it's really not going well at all, then there is a mechanism to just stop it and just learn from the failure and move on, and move on quickly. I think one lesson that we've learned over years is don't linger on into too much of analysis and get paralyzed in that process. Move on quickly. The whole thing is really also a bias for action.
All right. Where does innovation fit into the fewer, bigger, bolder methodology?
So one of the things that we find that the model of fewer, bigger, bolder applies to all functions, including innovation. So take some of the research work that we did. We found that some companies were spreading themselves thin by a lot of little innovation ideas. And in fact, in one of the interviews we did, they were called innovation junkies. Because essentially, it was almost like, what next, what next, what next? The output was really not few big bold. And when you apply a more disciplined process of initially starting with number of ideas, but then focusing on a few where you can win, not just because it is there, not because it looks nice, and then distorting resources against those and making them fewer, bigger, bolder. So to your question, innovation, this concept applies extremely well to the whole area of innovation. And this is across small companies, big companies, across industries.
One point I want to amplify on here in the innovation context is that as you look at the innovation funnel and the process, at the front end of it, you really need to widen that funnel. You need to be very creative. You need to look at a broad frontier of opportunities. And part of this, as we were talking about the blank checks, that when you're forced to really think out of the box because you've got these impossible targets, the team becomes very creative. They start to look at innovation in all of its dimensionality. And we make the observation that innovation, you know, is not just on product. It can be on the customer experience. It can be on process. It can be in routes to market. It can be on business model. It can be on manufacturing processes. It can be on partnerships. But once you do place your bets, they need to escalate the commitment and make sure you get it right. So the front end of the innovation process needs to be managed for flow and volume, but the latter part of the innovation process needs to be managed for yield and success rate. So it's really a switching off of risk management regimes as you proceed down the process. So there's both a widening of the funnel at the front end through looking at the full dimensionality of innovation opportunities, but then also making sure you're doing experimentation and adaptation while you're scaling up towards the back end of the process.
Let me ask you a question. An executive, a senior executive, might pick up the book, might not read the whole book, just sort of the cover notes and dabble a little bit in the front end, the back end, you know, do that typical executive level type of skimming that so happens in this case. And they might stumble across the chapter on organization. Does fewer, bigger, bolder as a concept require a change in an organizational structure, in an organizational culture? What are your thoughts on that?
One is that we argue that organizations are designed to perform. They're not designed to innovate. So the structure impedes their ability to pursue opportunities in an agile, nimble fashion. So one of the things that we argue in the book is that you don't want to necessarily disrupt the entire organization and the silos and the business units because that's needed for business as usual. But alongside that, you need to create what we call opportunity-focused organizations, which are smaller, more nimble units that you create that are designed not around a function or a business unit, but really around an opportunity. Now, these take various forms in different companies. They may be incubators. They may be, you know, an AT&T has the Emerging Devices Organization, IBM had the Emerging Business Organization, and so on. But the idea here is to create a parallel organization that can pursue opportunities and innovation initiatives more quickly, more nimbly, but then create a mechanism to then bring those initiatives back into the mothership as it scales. So I think that's one organization structural change that we talk about. The other really important thing is to overlay on top of your silos collaborative networks, and this is to sort of connect people across these silos, across business units, so that you can have a community around an area of expertise, around a domain that draws talent from across the organization. So we don't advocate destroying silos. We don't advocate destroying the organization that or disrupting it, but what we talk about sort of creating these opportunity-focused organizations that can live alongside and be the nimble or the sharp end of the spear, but also building collaborative networks that allow talent and ideas to more freely cut across the silos.
So other than being nimble and agile and doing things and learning while doing, it's also making sure that as far as possible, the organization is kept simple. Because
yeah.
We find in our work that complexity naturally creeps in. It's not ill-attended. As a result of that, what tends to happen in organizations is that they become highly internally focused. And our view here is it is very important not just to keep looking at the mirror and at yourself, but look outside the window at the world which is changing, the competition, and keep learning not only from yourself, but more importantly, from things outside. And that really feeds into the whole agility and nimbleness in execution. Because what we do argue in the book, that success at the end of the day is 90% execution and only 10% strategy.
Suppose a company, either large, medium-sized, or small, decides to undertake the Focus 7 concept and fewer, bigger, bolder. Where do you think is the place where the greatest risk lies? Where could things go wrong? Or where have things gone wrong and people have had to recover from it or they've had to adjust their strategy?
I can give you a specific example of a company I'm now involved in the U.S. It's a small company. It's about $40 million revenue. And what happened is they moved very quickly to $30, $40 million. But then they got so excited by their success that they started doing all kinds of stuff which really didn't go into the core of where they could win. As a result, they got unfocused, they diluted resources, and one or two bets really started going wrong. They're now applying Focus 7 to actually stop doing a lot of things. It's almost shrinking parts of their company to get back to what them successful in the first place. So I've seen this in another startup in Chicago, where again, they're just chasing too many rabbits, as Mohan said earlier. And the whole idea is applying Focus 7, which is what we're doing now, to get them doing fewer things which are bigger and bolder. So it applies, as I said, to both these cases where naturally they've just become complex and they didn't even have much size yet.
It might sound like complexity and lack of focus is an inevitable consequence of size. This is sort of a large company disease. But I do a lot of work with startups, all the way from two people in a garage up to sort of mid-sized companies. And in my experience, a startup company, even before they have a single product, can get unfocused. Because, in fact, when you're starting out a venture, every opportunity looks attractive. And there's 16 ways to go to market. There are, you know, 10 segments in opportunities you could pursue. No client business is business you want to turn down. So even before you've actually reached any measure of scale, you can find that you are B2B, you're B2C, you're going doing pursuing a white label strategy, a partner strategy, a direct-to-customer strategy, financial vertical market, you're in the retail vertical market, you have a product, you have a service, you have a solution, you have a subscription model. So complexity can come very, very early and focus can be lost very, very early. So startup companies can actually benefit a lot from this idea of sort of being very clear about what are the bets you're going to place. And because startup companies, you know, paradoxically, while they may not have too many divisions and silos and so on, but they also have very limited resources. And the most valuable resource that a startup company has is the bandwidth of the executive team and the ability to the sales force to call on people. So you really need to conserve those resources and move forward on a few fronts. So the ideas apply very much to a company in its infancy as well as large conglomerates and multinationals.
And just to wrap up your final question, your final chapter of the book is entitled Creating a Virtuous Cycle, where I would assume good begets good. And this really becomes one good thing turns on another, which turns on another, which turns on another. If you don't mind, if you could both just give your thoughts concluding our interview today on this idea of creating a virtuous cycle.
I think the important part here is Focus 7, which is a seven-step model, is not a one-time wonder game. It's not one of those things you do just to achieve your quarterly results. The virtuous cycle of growth is really trying to build a sustainable model for growth, which you continuously focus where you can win, which tends to have areas which have higher gross margins. You invest in those. You cut out the stuff which is not working, which very often is a tail and has lower gross margins, and continuously make things simple and reduce costs. Again, not mindlessly reduction of cost, but a focused reduction of keeping things simple. And that feeds into a sustainable growth model, which we have called the virtuous cycle of growth.
And what's implicit in this is that if you follow the cycle through, what you're doing is you're focusing where you can win, you're placing smarter and bigger bets, and then you're also simplifying the organization to take costs out of the system and to improve the margins. And that liberates resources to then make investments in brands, in marketing, in people, and in innovation that then throws off more cash that then the cycle repeats. So essentially, by continuously focusing and simplifying, you generate resources and cash that you can invest to drive that virtuous cycle. So that's really what it's about. Good doesn't only beget good. In a virtuous cycle, it's actually a virtuous spiral. Good begets better.
We've been speaking to Sanjay Khosla and Mohan Sahni, co-authors of a great book entitled Fewer, Bigger, Bolder, From Mindless Expansion to Focused Growth. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
AMA webcasts bring you 60 minutes of thought-provoking insight, specific answers to your management challenges, and conversations with renowned thought leaders. Best of all, they're all free. For a complete schedule of upcoming webcasts, visit the events calendar at amanet.org/events. Here at the AMA, we value your feedback. If you've ever attended any of our webcasts, webinars, or seminars, you've no doubt encountered our feedback surveys. Well, our podcasts are no different. You can either email us at podcast@amanet.org or call 800-697-3406. Your comments may become part of a future program. Thanks for taking us along. I'm Dave Summers, and you've been listening to AMA's Edgewise.